It's On Second Thought. I'm Tony Harris in for Celeste Headlee. Last week, we spoke to Rob Johnson of Gray, Georgia, whose brother Shannon died a year and a half ago in the mass shooting in San Bernardino, California.
After I got over the initial shock, my wife and I were laying in bed and were just kind of praying together, and we both just looked at each other and said, you know he saved somebody. You know he probably went after the shooter. That's just the way Shannon is. He's fiercely protective, and that's just the way Shannon is.
Shannon Johnson saved a coworker, shielding her from bullets. The shooters were a married couple.
Police say the suspects, 28-year-old Syed Rizwan Farouk and 27-year-old Tashfeen Malik, were shot dead in this black SUV at the end of a massive manhunt. Overnight, a SWAT team sweeping this Redlands home for explosives.
Until we know the motive or we really have something clear evidentiary based on that motive, I just don't want to weigh in on that right now. We have not ruled out terrorism.
New research from Georgia State University suggests in incidents like this, attackers' identities have an impact on the coverage. Here to talk more about this is Tony Lemieux. He oversees the Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University. Tony, good to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I want to start this conversation. I'm really looking forward to it because there are so many cases that you've taken the time to study and your group has taken the time to study that I've actually worked on and at various stages of this crazy career of mine. But I want to start with comments from the president. You no doubt heard these comments, but I want your reaction to them.
Radical Islamic terrorists are determined to strike our homeland as they did on 9/11, as they did from Boston to Orlando to San Bernardino and all across Europe. You've seen what happened in Paris and Nice. All over Europe, it's happening. It's gotten to a point where it's not even being reported. And in many cases, the very, very dishonest press doesn't want to report it.
So, Tony, you heard those comments from the president. What was your reaction?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that I would, you know, suggest that we clarify. I mean, the first, you know, most obvious one is the claim that things are not being reported. And in fact, our research looks at that very question, what is getting reported? And also, just in terms of the actual kinds of incidents, you know, it's one thing to focus on the problem of terrorism writ large, but what we saw there is really a focus on a particular type, particular set of perpetrators, and really at the expense of some of the other kinds of terrorism that we see that are also quite problematic. And so I think that's something we really need to address.
So I want to sort of support what you're saying here. This is from the Washington Post responding to that assertion from the president that the media actually underreports terror attacks. The reporting in the Post goes, the news media do not cover all terrorist attacks the same way. Rather, they give dramatically more coverage to attacks by Muslims, particularly foreign-born Muslims, even though those are far less common than other kinds of terrorist attacks. Does your research at this point support that assertion from the Washington Post?
Certainly in terms of, you know, if a Muslim perpetrator is being focused upon, then yes, you see significantly more coverage. In our analyses, and those led by Dr. Aaron Carnes, who's a postdoctoral research fellow here at the Global Studies Institute, really dug into this. We looked at the cases from the Global Terrorism Database over a 10-year period, and we looked at around 3,500 articles, news coverage of series of events. And what you find is that when there is a Muslim perpetrator, it's significantly more likely to be covered.
Tony, I want to rifle through a couple of bits of sound here and leading up to a question for you. Former Daily Show host Jon Stewart talked about on his show about the murder in 2015 of 9 people at Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, South Carolina. They were shot by a white man, Dylan Roof, in Charleston. Here's Jon Stewart, and then another piece of sound I want you to hear.
9 people shot in a church. What about that? That's the part that I cannot, for the life of me, wrap my head around. And you know it. You know that it's going to go down the same path. This is a terrible tragedy. They're already using the nuanced language of lack of effort for this. This is a terrorist attack.
And one more here for you, Tony. Let's talk. This is from the CBS Evening News. This is about a married couple, Amanda and Jared Miller, who went on a bit of a shooting spree. They fatally shot 2 police officers in Las Vegas before the Metro Police Department took them down.
Investigators described Jared and Amanda Miller as anti-government and on a mission to kill police officers. The couple entered this pizzeria around 11:30 yesterday and shot officers Igor Soldo and Alan Beck at point-blank range. The Millers then covered the bodies with a swastika and a Gadsden flag, first used in the American Revolution, emblazoned with the words, "Don't tread on me."
So, Tony, do we know why a violent incident, a mass shooting event, or a mass casualty event of any kind, why some of those incidents get labeled as terrorism and others don't?
Well, and this is really, I think, the crux of our research. You know, first of all, documenting it, you know, showing that there is, in fact, a phenomena there. It goes beyond, you know, looking at a handful of cases anecdotally and saying, oh, yeah, there's a difference here. One of the things that we've done in our research is looked at the actual reportage of various incidents as classified in the Global Terrorism Database. So that's the first piece of it. And there is a difference. There is a difference that's really clearly linked to the identity of the perpetrator. The other thing that some of our research has focused in on is what makes people, you know, a broader public, a broader audience, perceive something as terrorism in the first place. You know, is there something that is really inherent to the identity of the perpetrator, the type of attack, you know, the modality? Does a use of a bomb, for instance, feel more like terrorism than a gun? And what about a lone actor versus a group? Or what about the target? And we've done experiments to really tease out some of those factors as well. So we've got you know, this sort of perspective that hones in on those very core questions. But it really does seem, you know, to have a very significant relationship with the identity of the perpetrator. That's really the thing that seems to be driving what gets considered terrorism in the first place, what gets conceptualized that way. Mm.
So we're talking about new research that looks at media coverage of terror attacks. My guest is Tony Lemieux of the Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University. One more bit of sound I want you to hear. This is from Maniba Salim. She is a social psychologist at the University of Michigan. She did a study in which volunteers were actually randomly assigned to watch video news clips with different portrayals of Muslims. Salim told NPR that after participants watched the negative news clips, they supported all kinds of unconstitutional policies targeting Muslim Americans.
So we saw people supporting policies such as domestic surveillance without the consent of Muslim Americans. We saw individuals supporting perhaps that Muslim Americans should not be allowed to vote, that they should have separate and more thorough airport security lines, that they should be monitored, you know, by the government.
So, Tony, let's take a step back here. What was the question, maybe the set of questions that drove your research project, and what perception or perceptions were you responding to?
Well, I think the initial impetus for the current sort of effort, it really, for me, sprung from the differential, the coverage of the Frazier-Glenn Miller attack in Kansas City. That particular event really, to me, highlighted the very stark difference. And one of the things that stood out was he was getting taken away by police. He was in custody, and he was yelling Heil Hitler.
Yeah.
And
so, Tony,
you know,
why don't we go back and explain that Frazier-Glenn Miller attack?
So Frazier-Glenn Miller shot and murdered people at a Jewish community center, really specific targeting. Now, here's somebody who
ended up not being Jewish.
Right. He ended up, you know, here was somebody who had a long history of activity in the white supremacist movement and Ku Klux Klan, and clearly had this motivational state, as evidenced by, you know, as he was getting taken away, this kind of yelling about Heil Hitler. And initially, you know, I looked at it and I said, why isn't this getting covered, you know, to the extent that it probably ought to be? And I said, you know, I bet it would be really different had he been yelling Allahu Akbar. And it really got... it really bothered me, and I actually wrote a blog about it that very evening, and then said, you know, what we can do is really use this as an impetus to do some research to see what it is about that sort of difference that drives the kind of perception that ultimately would result in people thinking of something as terrorism or not. And it was that event, and it was the differential coverage that really drove it. And then, Charleston. So here was the kind of interesting thing, and we're still working on some of this data, but we went and did an experiment that tested those factors I mentioned before, the identity of the perpetrator, the use of a gun versus a bomb, the type of the target, you know, religious institution versus a government building, and a lone versus a group attacker. Mm-hmm. We did that, and we saw, you know, again, this identity of the perpetrator really explain the lion's share of the findings about what would get called terrorism or not. And as you would, you know, hypothesize, if it's perpetrated by a Muslim, participants were much more likely to label it as terrorism and be more confident in that. We then, you know, about 2 months later, the Charleston attack happened, and another instance where it wasn't, you know, initially called terrorism.
That's right.
Much. And that John Stewart clip that you played before really stood out to me, because I said, aha, now we're actually seeing something in the public dialogue to call this what it is, and frankly, what it would be called if the identity of the perpetrator were a little bit different. And so that, you know, prompted us to really quickly develop some additional measures and get back into the field. So now we can look at, did this event in Charleston have any impact over time on how people would label an attack as terrorism or not? And we looked at what kind of coverage they were exposed to. Now, we're still working on the analyses of that. It's a very complex set of data.
Yeah.
But these things all sort of linked up and got us thinking about, well, now let's look at actual cases. And my biggest concern in all of this, I mean, there's actually several, but one is that if we fail to look at events like Jared and Amanda Miller as terrorism, we label it as a shooter, we kind of explain it away, we then fail to connect the dots. We fail to see things based on the motivational attributes, which is kind of a core piece of the terrorist definition being applied, but also based on what people actually do, the behavioral elements. And it doesn't do us any service to do that. It really causes problems. And I think the other kind of parallel finding that you know, the listeners would like to know about is that, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a study that START did and some colleagues published that looked at what law enforcement is worried about. What do they see as the biggest
threat? Absolutely. Yep.
And one of the things they said was, look, we've got these sovereign citizens, and we've got people who are really, you know, they're armed. They're very concerned. They don't think that, you know, police have any legitimacy.
These are anti-government groups.
Yes.
I'm thinking of groups like the Oath Keepers, who are anti-government in nature and philosophy.
And ready for, you know, conflict to ensue. And that's one of the things, especially with this, you know, the sort of the sovereign citizens and to some extent the patriot movements and the white supremacist groups as well, where, you know, law enforcement says this is a real problem that we have and a threat, and it's going unrecognized, you know, more broadly, but not by law enforcement to the same extent, you know, to people who say this is what we actually have to worry about and deal with.
Tony, can I ask you before I run out of time here, how do we view terrorism moving forward if it is more accurately covered? I'm thinking back on the New York Post article that the media actually gives dramatically more coverage to attacks by Muslims, particularly foreign-born Muslims, even though those are far less common than other kinds of terrorist attacks. If it the coverage were more balanced, how might that impact our overall impression of terrorism?
So, you know, we don't really know definitively, but I do think that it would either be met with some kind of resistance that, you know, hey, look, that doesn't comport with my
yes.
reality and my expectations. So people may be a little bit less likely to buy into that. And that's one of the things we're actually actively figuring out how to test that. The other thing that it might do is give people a little bit more of a realistic sense. But again, it gets disproportionately covered, and so people, I think, are more concerned with the risk of terrorism and the threat of terrorism, you know, than would be warranted otherwise. If it's labeled as terrorism and, you know, there's a Muslim perpetrator, it's going to stay in that news cycle longer. You're going to see more about, you know, going into the, you know, well, why did they do it, and who were they talking to, and what did they say online, and all of those kinds of things that are part of it. And, you know, again, that's another thing that we're looking into, is that sort of differential way that things are run to ground.
Questions that we don't necessarily ask Jared and Amanda Miller or of them or of the shooter at the Colorado Springs a Planned Parenthood center. We don't, generally speaking, ask those same questions of motives about those individuals, or if there is a discussion, it happens and we're moving on.
I think, yeah, that's part of the real big problem here. You know, the question about, well, how did they radicalize? You know, who were they talking to? What were they, you know, those things don't quite, you know, get the same level of scrutiny or attention. And again, we fail to connect those dots at our broader peril. I mean, there are real active threats and problems out there, and they're not just in any one particular category of this form of violence. And so I think we've really got to have a more realistic and more inclusive sense of when we say terrorism, what we actually mean.
Particularly when we know that someone like Dylann Roof was almost exclusively radicalized online.
Well, and you know, in that particular case, there were things that, you know, ultimately came out in the investigation and in the trial, and, you know, this kind of longstanding sentiment, what he wanted the violence to do, in terms of, you know.
Oh, he was very clear about that.
Yeah. So there's things like that emerge, and it's like, well, if that's not terrorism, then what is? Because it really is that, you know, violence or threat of violence to affect some kind of social or political change through this sort of intimidation, fear, things that gets people to really look at it in that light. And so by all definitional criteria that we could apply here, short of specifically labeling, you know, based on the identity of a perpetrator, it had all those hallmarks.
Yeah, label it, full stop, move on, let's have the deeper discussion.
I think that's where we really need to get to.
That is Tony Lemieux. He is from the Global Studies Institute at Georgia State University. Enjoyed that, Tony. Thank you.
Thanks for having me, Tony.